Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with the Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. The whole discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Marcia Castro, Chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We talked about the coronavirus pandemic and Latin America's unfolding crisis.
More than a million COVID deaths have been recorded in Latin America and the Caribbean. And as of this month, about a third of all deaths around the world come from this region. Only 3% of the population is fully vaccinated. So you can see a big disconnect there. Marcia, to begin, in March, we spoke in the same forum about the situation specifically in Brazil. What's changed since then in Brazil and in addition throughout the region?
Thanks, Alana. So since March, when we last spoke, we saw the situation continue to worsen in Brazil. So by the end of March, about 66,000 deaths were reported, and April became the deadliest month in Brazil since the beginning of the pandemic. We had more than 82,000 deaths. In fact, by April 25th, the number of COVID deaths in 2021 surpassed all deaths reported in 2020. In some capital cities in Brazil, the number of deaths was larger than the number of births. And this happened particularly in April. And that's a demographic pattern that Brazil had not observed before and was not really expected to observe until the second half of the 2040s, according to population projections. There were calls for lockdown, which some cities did implement in Brazil, but those measures continued to face no support from the federal government. A new minister of health took term at the end of March. That's the fourth minister Brazil has since the pandemic started. And in early April, a parliamentary investigation into the actions of President Bolsonaro and his former ministers were launched in Brazil. It's still underway. And the goal is to assess the government's response to the pandemic.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. I mean, I can talk more about what's happening in Latin America, but...
What do you anticipate happening as this continues?
So there are a few things that we have to think about, right? So if you take the case of Brazil, which is what is happening now in other countries in Latin America, the moment that some decline is being observed in cases and deaths, there is this idea of relaxing some of the measures that were done before. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why things got out of control, both in Chile and in Argentina. And we can talk more about this. But in the case of Brazil, there are some places now that they show the first signs of another surge that could happen in cases and deaths. So we keep having those different moments of increases and declines. And if we don't do anything different from what we've done before, then it begs the question, are we just creating the perfect conditions for new variants to emerge and then bring a very serious threat of putting us back to a square zero if we have a variant that evades immunity of previous infections, but particularly evades immunity given from vaccine. So it's not a comfortable situation for the region, but actually for the entire world.
You talked specifically about Brazil, but alluded to other parts of Latin America. In our earlier discussion, there was starting to be some spillover from the high infection rates and outbreaks in Brazil. What's been happening in other parts of Latin America?
Yeah, so the situation in Latin America also got worse. And one of the big reasons is that the P1 variant has spread across the region.
And that was first discovered in Manaus?
That's the variant that was... initially, the alarm was raised by Japan which had some migrants that came from Brazil, and then it was found in Manaus. So the P1 is the variant that we believe emerged in Manaus. And a lot of people basically argue that's one of the main reasons for the sharp increase in cases and deaths across the region, across Latin America. And in fact, we have a study that just came out about a bit less than 2 weeks ago that analyzed the data from Manaus, and they estimate that up to 31% of all P1 infections that happened in Manaus early this year were actually reinfections. So we had another study showing that this variant is more transmissible, up to 2.4 times more transmissible. And now we have some evidence that it's actually pretty high, the rate of reinfections, people that had the disease before and got infected again with P1. If we look at the data just from last week, about a quarter of daily cases and about 30% of the daily deaths in the world were registered in Latin America. Uruguay, which was a country that last year managed to avoid a high burden, did a pretty good job, saw a major surge and became the country in Latin America with the highest daily number of cases per 100,000 people since early April, and the highest daily number of deaths per 100,000 people since mid-April. Chile also reported record high numbers despite high vaccination coverage, and we can talk more about this. But basically, 2021 has been really devastating for the Latin American region.
There's a lot in there, and I want to kind of pick apart and some of those reference questions that have already come in. If we can just rewind for a moment, because one of the things you talked about is the way that communities may relax restrictions and then the cases go up. But we also know, for example, in the United States, that one of like the big keys to turning the corner is vaccinations. Uh-huh. And so, for example, in Brazil, almost 9% of people in Brazil are vaccinated, 5% in Argentina. Across the region, it's only about 3% that are fully vaccinated. What are some of the obstacles to vaccinations in the region? Because that seems to be a big vulnerability.
Yeah. So, actually, the two countries that have the highest percentage of vaccination in the region from 2 days ago, when I checked the numbers, is Chile is about 50%. And Argentina is actually 45%. Huh. But many countries are below 10%. Another number of countries have not even vaccinated 5% of the population. And that includes Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Bolivia, which is one of the poorest countries in the region, Peru, and Paraguay. Now, all of those countries are participating in the COVAX facility, but there is a shortage of vaccines. Some countries thought that they tried to secure extra doses of vaccines like Argentina and Peru, but they have complained that the agreement terms demanded by Western pharmaceutical companies were too tough, including liability waivers, but above all, long confidentiality clauses that they didn't really like when they saw this contract. And because all the purchase agreements are confidential, so you never know exactly how much other countries paid for the vaccine, it's all secret, the negotiating power of low and middle income countries is very limited. In addition, there is reports of widespread disinformation, and that brings challenge to vaccine uptake. That varies by country. Everything I read from Chile says that disinformation is not really a big deal, probably because of the way the government is communicating. But there is also something we have to consider, which is the political scenario that has not been very friendly for evidence-based decisions on some countries. And here, Brazil and Mexico are two examples. And that contributed to major delays in securing vaccine, among other problems related to the pandemic response. But I want to give some piece of good news, and we do have some good news. There's some preliminary evidence showing that vaccines are really contributing to reduce deaths among the elderly. And we did a study in Brazil showing that while throughout the entire pandemic, the proportion of deaths among people aged 80 and plus, COVID deaths, was always around 25 and 30%. And this starts to decline in February this year. And Brazil started vaccinating early January. So by April, it's only 15%. So again, it's preliminary evidence, but it's important because it helps with the communication that people should go there, get the vaccine, and above all, make it clear that they need to get both doses of the vaccine in order to be protected.
What happened in Chile then? And now it makes me wonder also about Argentina, where the rates are higher. I mean, obviously 45% is not 90%. But on the one hand, I guess that leads to two questions. What did Chile do well and differently? And then what
went wrong?
The rise in infections anyway.
Yeah, so I think Chile is really an interesting case. So in terms of vaccination, there are three things that are important to mention. So the first one is that the country secured enough doses in advance to vaccinate the entire population twice. So they planned ahead. So planning was there. They signed the contracts before safety and efficacy data were released. They hosted clinical trials, and that involves agreements to then receive vaccine. So they did a good job in planning. The second thing is that Chile had a network of health facilities that are often used to distribute the flu shots to the mm-hmm. population and vaccines for children. And they do this every year. So in using this network, Chile was able to phase out the vaccination by groups. So they didn't need appointments and there were no long lines, nothing like we saw in the US. So they basically had the infrastructure to facilitate mass vaccination campaigns in place and they used that. And the third thing I think is important to mention, as I highlighted before, is that the sort of anti-vaccine sentiment seemed to be very low in the country. So despite all of that, Chile has reported a record high number of cases by mid-April, and that begs the question, what went wrong? So it's interesting to see that after very strict measures were implemented last year, Chile pretty much kept the borders closed from March to November 2020. So they started to reopen in November, including to tourism. And it's important to highlight that all of this reopening happened before vaccination. Vaccination only started late December. Mm. So people started to travel for summer holidays before being vaccinated. And there was this feeling that we've done it. And then there was, people relaxed in terms of behavior, like using masks. There was not a very clear communication that they needed the second dose. So that's something that they also had to revise and that they needed to continue to use masks after vaccination. So, and then in the middle of all of this, P1 arrived and it's believed that it really also played a major role in the increase of cases. So it's this story of that we have in public health, that when you do a good job, there's this sentiment, we've done it, now that's okay. But, in this pandemic, nothing is okay because we're only going to be okay when we control the situation in every single country.
This question's from Jan. It's on the flip, or maybe the other country we've referenced quite a bit with Uruguay. You know, it was hailed as, quote, winning against COVID-19. And now it's taken a turn having the worst daily COVID-19 deaths per capita in the world. So this question is, what happened? Like, what went wrong to bring on such a tragic turnaround?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people and a lot of researchers in Uruguay usually say that Uruguay had two pandemics, one before November and one after November 2020. Mm-hmm. And the actions from last year, if you follow the timeline of what happened in Uruguay, they really were aligned with science. Whatever was being implemented was effective. And all of this was done so well that Uruguay never really had a strict lockdown. And that's also important to mention. I mean, they did close the borders.
Well, then how did they manage that? Just by masking, distancing?
And they planned ahead. The key thing in this pandemic is if you plan ahead and you avoid the initial major surge, you don't have to do lockdown. Lockdown comes as a response of things got out of control. But if you plan ahead, if you try to contain before things get out of control, you can still keep managing that way without really having to shut down everything. They did close the borders, and that's important. That's really important. However, you know, if you look at the border between Brazil and Uruguay, it is binational and people can just cross. So that border was not really closed. The movement didn't stop along that border. And the introduction of P1 is really considered as one of the reasons that things got out of control, connected to a sense that Uruguay has done such a good job. Everything is under control. Vaccination is going fast. We're going to be in good shape. But, you know, as fast as vaccination is going, it's about 45% of the population that received at least one dose of the vaccine. And the main vaccine being used in Uruguay is CoronaVac. So again, I think it's not exactly the same case as Chile, but kind of similar. But the main factor here is really this very fluid border with Brazil. And it was very easy for the variant to arrive at a time when people that thought that the job is done, we're in good shape, and it's not going to be a problem anymore.
So I want to get back to, you mentioned the vaccine issue, the access issue, COVAX, which is this global supplier, the contract issues. Last week, the director of the Pan-American Health Organization, PAHO, Carissa Etienne, called for an increase in production of vaccines and medical supplies in Latin America and the Caribbean, so that the region would not have to depend on imports from elsewhere. How might this help, but also like how might that happen?
That's a great question. And honestly, I think to some extent, this pandemic made it very clear what is the price to pay for a globalized world. So last year, all countries wanted the same goods at the same time, and they're produced by a handful of countries only. So there was not enough for everybody. If you take Latin America, it's less than 4% of all the medical products in use during the COVID response have come from the region. And that's a number from the Pan-American Health Organization. So the whole idea of improving the local production is great, but for some countries, it will take time and a lot of investment in infrastructure and capacity building to be able to start or to expand local production. So this is not going to happen immediately, but it has to happen. And collaborations among the countries in the region would be beneficial. And I think PAHO can play a major role in making this happen, in facilitating this to happen. In the case of vaccines, some countries in the region do have the research institutions, the expertise, the personnel, and the capacity to produce vaccines. And here, Argentina, Mexico, and Brazil are three examples. They are producing vaccines, but they still rely on the shipment of the active ingredient, the ingredient to make the vaccines. And they come from China and from India, for example. However, they all signed technology transfer agreements. So once the agreement is in place, once the technology is transferred, they can produce the active ingredient in the vaccine locally. And this is about to happen in a few months. But here I want to highlight that even under funding limitations, under limitations of resources in the region, there are several groups working on vaccine development. There are at least three groups working on vaccine development in Brazil, and Cuba may become the very first Latin America country to develop and manufacture its own vaccine against COVID-19. It's the only country in the region that has not joined the COVAX facility. And it has five vaccines in development, two of which, called Soberana 2 and Abdala, have reached final stages of phase 3 trial and now intervention trial. In an interview to the journal Nature, Dr. Ben Como, who is the director general of the Finland Institute of Vaccines in Havana, reported that during the trial phases, two doses of Soberana 2 generated an antibody response in about 80% of vaccinated people, and a third booster dose of Soberana Plus raised that percentage to 100%, all of them with neutralizing antibodies that can block the virus from entering cells. So this is extremely exciting, and it will be great to see the full results of the trial published and the ongoing vaccination in Cuba. The expectation is that by August, about 70% of the population would be vaccinated. So I think a lot of people are eager to see what's going to come out of this. And this would be an incredible undertaking. And I think the region should take that momentum and benefit from that. And I hope PAHO will help make this happen.
Is the idea that a vaccine like this, the technology could more easily be transferred to those manufacturing facilities elsewhere in Latin America, or even provide more material for making, because with COVAX and with these other things, and even when you're talking about with the technology transfer happening right now, that still takes time. And it seems like time is difficult, assuming that these results are what they are.
Yeah, everything takes time. I mean, and despite the fact that it takes time, it's being done in such a shorter period of time that we've never seen before. But the hope is that, and I'm sure that that's the idea, that Cuba would be eager to help other nations in Latin America as well. Through the coordination of PAHO, I think the entire region could benefit from this. If there's going to be a technology transfer, I don't know, but just the prospect of having other potential vaccine candidates that are effective, that can be produced right there in the region, and that could benefit the low and middle income countries in the region that are really, really lagging behind in vaccination coverage, I think there's something for us to hope for, that this would work and could benefit, particularly the poorer countries in Latin America.
This question comes from Danny. It's building on that and some other things you referenced. To what extent are countries throughout Latin America working together to coordinate their responses? And are most international borders closed or open?
That's a good question. And I think it depends on the country and it depends on the government. Closing and opening borders varied over time, and they varied depending on the transmission, the increased transmission and the emergence of variants. So, for example, once P1 came, a lot of countries closed borders with Brazil. But some of the governments are horrible in diplomacy at this point. So, they're not really open to work together. So, but we do have examples of solidarity in the region. And I'll give you one. In Manaus, when the city ran out of oxygen, Venezuela helped Brazil. They sent 5 trucks with about 140,000 liters of oxygen. And they offer the oxygen, and because the Brazilian president doesn't like the president of Venezuela for whatever reasons, but so they could have sent a plane from the army, a military plane, to bring the oxygen, but they didn't. So all the oxygen came in 5 trucks. It took 2 days on the road to arrive to Manaus. It could have been much faster if the Brazilian government had sent the plane. And they, the Brazilian president didn't even thank the president of Venezuela for sending the oxygen. So the solidarity is there. There could be many more country collaborations, I think. But again, it really depends on the government. But there are things going on. PAHO plays a major role, and then there are some actions that are done between countries. But we still face a lot of limitations because of the political climate in some countries. And that's a real shame. It's a missed opportunity.
I want to combine 2 questions that have come in. It has to do on the theme of how to help in terms of organizations potentially outside of the political leadership of countries. One is from Robert, with the progress in the US, massive lab testing capacity has become available. Is there any way that US-based labs can help Latin American nations with their testing and quarantine efforts? And then I just want to tag this on from Misha. What can governments, NGOs, and individuals outside Latin America do right now to support the coronavirus responses there?
Yeah, so those are great questions. I think that we still don't have enough testing. Many countries in Latin America still do not have enough testing. So now that we have antigen tests, it would be fantastic for some countries in Latin America to be able to connect the ones that have, for example, community health workers, to be able to connect those community health workers with those antigen tests so they can carry those tests and help with monitoring, testing, and even tracing if we reach a moment in time that we can do that when cases are lower and we can do that. There is a lot that can be done from local groups. For example, if we take countries that face this challenging political climate where we don't really expect that actions are going to come from the federal government, but we see actions now emerging from coalitions of mayors, of governors, of civil society, of community leaders, researchers as well, that now are doing beyond just research, but actually pairing with groups to write protocols, to provide training to frontline workers that work in the community. We need a lot in terms of producing material and joining efforts to combat disinformation. That is a huge problem that we still face. We face this everywhere, but particularly in a lot of polarized societies that we have in Latin America, trying to do a better job on that is critical. Distribution of high quality masks. It's unbelievable that at this point we still have people wearing low quality masks. And I know in the US we're moving towards, if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask outside. We are far from this in the vast majority of countries in Latin America. So being able to distribute high quality masks to teachers, to bus drivers, to all those people that they have no choice. They have to be out there every single day and they have a higher exposure of being infected because of the nature of the work that they do. If we can get more of those people working in the community, especially in a region like Latin America, that it's one of the regions that has the highest levels of inequality, being able to be right there on the ground, helping those people that maybe don't have the right information, maybe are the ones being the target of the disinformation, that they can't work remotely, that they have what Dr. Fauci calls the double exposure to the virus. So trying to do something locally would be great. Hmm. And honestly, I think richer countries can do more to promote a more equitable distribution of vaccines. And this has been discussed a lot in low and middle income countries. I know it's great if we can start vaccinating adolescents, but some countries haven't even started vaccinating their elderly. So we need to make a very serious reflection and think about how we actually put aside the political discussions about vaccines and promote a more equitable distribution.
This question is from Alexandra. You've mentioned P1 variant and some of these dynamics with policies of loosening restrictions or certain types of restrictions prematurely in the plans. To what degree is the P1 variant driving the surge throughout the region? I know you talked on this a little bit before. And what other factors are driving the surge?
So for sure, P1 contributed not only to, create part of the situation we're seeing, but also contributed a little bit on the sort of more younger pattern of infections that we're seeing. And there are some reports showing how P1 may also have increased the mortality among pregnant women in the region. So it's a lot of reason for concern. Beyond P1, I think that in some countries, and I gave two examples, Uruguay and Chile, it's this idea that we've done a good job. In other countries like Brazil, it's not really taking a control approach that is different from what you've done before. So then, you know, you are just going to keep seeing the same thing repeating over and over again, but they can repeat in a much worse way than before. And when I say not doing anything different is we need more testing and we didn't get it. We need the community health workers on the ground and we didn't get it. We need to be very careful on how you reopen things after you close, because you know you really have to be in a comfortable situation, not when the curve is still very high, and that didn't happen. So basically the one thing we discuss a lot in public health, we need to learn the lessons from the past. And now it's not even a long time past. It's not that much in the past, but it's like a few months ago. And we are not exactly learning in terms of improving the control policies. But again, that's context specific. Do we have an environment that values science, listens to science, and therefore there is a room to learn from science and do it better? And unfortunately, in a few countries in Latin America, we don't have that.
This question is from Mira. I know I'm going very quickly. I'm sitting with what you just said. It's very powerful, which is there have been reports of secret vaccination programs letting the wealthy and powerful jump to the head of the line, for example, in Peru and Argentina. You know, as these limited vaccines become available, how common do you think this really is?
Yeah, so the rules do vary by country, and even inside the same country, rules can vary across different states, and that is particularly seen in places where you lack a national coordination of the vaccine rollout. For the most part, vaccination is started with healthcare professionals, and then there were combinations of, you know, prioritizing age, certain groups like people with health conditions or elderly, even institutions, teachers, the incarcerated population. So there is a huge variation, but it's basically this: healthcare professionals, age, and some groups. Now, there were no particular efforts in setting priorities based on inequalities. And in fact, vaccine tourism, as it's being called, is happening right now. So you have wealthy people from Latin America, from many different countries, they fly to the US to be vaccinated. And in many, many places in the US, you don't even need an ID to get a vaccine. And usually they take the Janssen & Janssen because then it's one shot. And there have been also reports of people that cut the line. I'm not sure how common they are, but you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And the main point in here is that this should not be happening at all. And again, that involves solidarity, that involves ethics, that involves respect for the vulnerable and recognition that we have inequalities. And honestly, I think some of those priorities should take into account inequalities. And for the most part in the countries, they don't even consider that.
There's a couple of questions that have come in, if you've still got time, and they're kind of region specific, if you have some insight into this. One is from Robert, thanking you for clear information about South America, but what about Central America, in particular, a place like Guatemala? Robert's thinking, trying to restart, for example, surgical missions to the region and trying to figure out what is going on.
Yeah, so in Central America, most of the countries in Central America still have very low vaccination rollout. They are all part of the COVAX facility. Guatemala, Nicaragua, all of those countries have less than 5% of the population vaccinated. And some of those countries are in the COVAX facility, but they depend solely on the COVAX facility. So other countries are in the COVAX, but they can also buy, they're trying to buy other doses. So, you know, the situation is not much better. And I agree with Robert, those countries may not make the headlines as often as other bigger countries, but the cases are still, if you consider per 100,000 population, because the numbers are going to be small because of the population. So they are still facing the burden. They also have high inequality rates. And again, the vaccine rollout should be much faster in order to mitigate the problem. But so far, this is not the case.
Robert also alluded to efforts to find good information. And I know that's been a story, whether it's in Brazil or a place like Nicaragua, with the reporting of what's going on. And I wonder how much that's a challenge, or how you as a researcher figure out, based on data or outside government data, what's going on.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think data is an important issue in this pandemic. And we have major contrasts, right? So we have countries that historically have good records of having data, being very transparent, having good data from civil registration system as well. So deaths get recorded, births get recorded, and you have a good health information system that usually you can use for any diseases, and you can just leverage on them when you have a pandemic. That's not the case for all countries. Some countries don't even have a civil registration system, so we can barely exactly know how many deaths are in there. Now, you don't have to be a poor country to not have data. Remember, in the US, some states still don't report how many deaths you had by race and ethnicity. Now, PAHO tries to bring together data for all countries. And if you go to the PAHO website, we can get numbers, but it's not enough to detail this by age, by sex, by region. So you can try to model how did the virus spread, which regions were affected first, how it is spreading over time, is it disproportionately affecting certain groups? For that, you really need detailed data. And I personally never try to find data for those countries. I know, for example, you're talking about Central America. So Mexico technically is not Central America, but I consider part of the central area in Latin America. So Mexico has some data. Other countries, I don't know. I never tried to look at data for Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, for example. All the data that I get is from PAHO, which again, it's all aggregated. So maybe they do have some data, and I'm not aware. Maybe they just don't have enough information systems. But the point is, data is absolutely crucial, because any country trying to make decisions based on science, they need the data in the first place to be able to understand how things are unfolding, where the problems are so you can address them. Who are the people being left behind so you can go there and give protection? Without good information, detailed information, we don't know where it is, who is left behind, who is being more affected, and then you don't have the right answers to be able to address the problem.
We're about out of time, but I wanted to just ask you this one concluding question that you've alluded to that I've been thinking about a lot. But it seemed like from our last discussion that you were kind of busy, at least in your mind, writing some extra chapter to the textbooks of global health and public health. And a big theme and wake-up call was about the role of leadership in health responses that have really been accentuated in the pandemic. And Brazil is a really powerful example. As we revisit this conversation now here in May, I wonder what kind of main additional or building on that parts of that chapter you might want to be stressing, or even titles of this kind of like lessons right now for public health response that you're seeing as you look at what's happening in Latin America.
Yeah, so I think the last time we spoke, I indicated how worried I was about what could unfold in Brazil. And sure enough, April was a completely devastating month. And just yesterday, we surpassed 450,000 lives lost. And now we have this investigation going on from the Senate. So, I mean, I think we keep adding subsections in this chapter that basically show how incredible it is, this sort of failed leadership, in the sense that the same arguments keep being used over and over again. The whole issue around the ineffective treatments, hydroxychloroquine, these things keep coming back, and you would wonder, how much does it take for this to be completely out? Let's talk about something else. Let's try to find solutions. Let's try to do things we haven't done before. And it's just amazing how persistent those things are. And above all, how a large fraction of people still support this kind of leadership. It worries me a lot, and it makes me wonder if, in writing this imaginary chapter, we just have to broaden it. This is beyond the pandemic. This is the future for a lot of countries in the region. Is this the kind of leadership we really want? Latin America is one of the most unequal regions in the world. Inequality is increasing across the board. There is a report from CEPAL that we're probably going to go back a decade in economic growth, 14 years in terms of poverty reduction. So we're going back. So this is way beyond the pandemic. We really have to figure out what kind of society we want to be. The society that is solidary, it looks at each other, understands that nobody will be done with this pandemic until everybody's done with this pandemic? Or are we going to be the society that is always, I go first, and then, we're really never going to get rid of structural inequality in the world. And I hope it's not the second option, because I don't think it's sustainable. So I don't know. I don't know how this chapter will end, Ilana. It's a very complicated chapter, but I sure hope that I could start adding some more hope and positive touches in this chapter. And I'll hold on to that, because I need that hope to keep moving on.
That was Marcia Castro, chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page, and you can find that at theworld.org/Facebook, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.